Now, the great thing is, if there's a question I don't know the answer to, rare, I know, or that I think, wow, I need to ponder that a lot longer, I can make it into a sermon later in the year. Because this is one of the great ways I find out every year or two what's on everybody's mind, although I hope you'll come tell me at other times as well. Wow, let's start with a small one here. If to forgive doesn't include to forget, then what does it truly mean to forgive, especially of oneself? Well, yeah, I don't think it means to forget. In fact, forgiveness, I don't think has much meaning if you've forgotten something. If you can really put it out of your mind completely, then it's not a burden, is it? I don't know if I'm so good at forgiving myself, so I'm thinking more about experiences of trying to forgive others. To me, it seems very wrapped up in humility, you know, an awareness that we make mistakes, and accepting that we really, really mess up and so do other people. It doesn't make everything okay. It certainly doesn't we forget, and it doesn't automatically mean forgiveness either, but I think it's a step toward forgiveness, a move toward forgiveness, because, you know, it humanizes the experience. Like, oh, okay. We do really bad things. It's part of what it means to be human, and so I can understand. I could be in that place, or I could, if it's a matter of forgiving ourselves, I could. My wife and I have a phrase, when I was young and stupid. Well, I was young and stupid then. It's a sense that, you know, we are different now, and if we're going to move on in our lives, we have to be able to deal gently with who we were. That's a piece of it. You see, I know I'll have fabulous thoughts about this on my way home, so, you know, we may have a sermon about that later. And thank you for writing your name, because I can get back to you about that. Tell us a little bit about the branch. You know, I learned a lot about the branch several years ago when I did a service on it and asked people what they thought about it. So I just know a sort of basic history, which is that when this church was first built in the late 1950s, there wasn't anything on this wall. And someone whose name I have forgotten but is written down in our archives brought a big Madrone branch from their property and put it up on the wall. And there have been a few because they kind of crumble over the years. They dry out, start dropping onto the choir and stuff, you know. This one has lasted a really long time, though. I think it's been gently polyurethane, and that's held it, and it still looks very natural to me, so I think it's lovely. So I didn't learn just how much the branch meant to people until I rather precipitously, I apparently turned our worship space 90 degrees for several months. And we were facing this way. And when some people liked it, some people didn't, some people were neutral, but among the people who really, really disliked it, one of the chief reasons was, I meditate on the branch. The branch is really important to me, and I like to be facing it. And I was so moved by that. I like it too, but I hadn't known how much it had meant to people. So some people say it kind of, it symbolizes nature to them, or it symbolizes the unity and diversity, how diversity comes out of one place. People have talked about sort of fractal patterns in it. And some people say, it's a dead tree, which leads me to think they probably don't like it, but yeah. Anyway, I always love hearing what people think about it. It's not a universal UU symbol. You'll see a chalice in almost every UU church, although the fact that ours is shaped like a tree is, if not unique, rare. And then the branch is just us, as far as I know. What to do to overcome sadness about Trumpism and hurt caused by Donald Trump? Do you read my Facebook feed? Do you think I know anything about this? Except channel it into snark, which I do not advise. It's just my coping mechanism. I don't think it's a particularly useful one. You know, my father had this great quote on the wall from the Once and Future King. When I was a kid, well, it's on the wall of our house. I assume it. My dad put it up because he loved that book, and he and it says the cure for sadness is to learn something. But I think in this case, the cure for sadness is to do something. I mean, be sad. That's not the, I don't think the goal is to cure sadness, just to deal with it, I guess, because it's sad-making and angry-making and scary, and, you know, I don't want anybody to stop feeling all those things. But, yeah, to do something. Take some action. Unite with people who are making the world better. I mean, that's an answer to a lot of things, but. Are UU's moving to a more or less creedal faith? If you don't know the sort of theological background of this, we are not a creedal faith. There's no one creed we believe, and we do have seven principles that we must reconsider every, I think, two decades or so. And last time we were asked to reconsider them, the overwhelming response was, no, they're good, don't change them. But there's a conversation about adding an eighth right now, for example, about racism and working against racism and oppression. And we do tend to take them as a creed sometimes, but they're not. Specifically, it is explicitly said that we cannot use them as a creedal test. So if you want to join this, the congregation says, yes, we affirm and promote these things, but if you want to join the church and you say, I really have a problem with principle whatever, hey, that's fine. It's not like you must believe in this, this, and this to be a UU. Nevertheless, I think there's a sort of pendulum swing between we're so loosey-goosey and nobody knows what we're about and we don't know how to communicate ourselves and we go more creedal, and then we don't want to be a creedal faith. There's a reason that we left it wide open and we swing back here. And, you know, the swing is dynamic and I think that's okay. I think we're in a pretty strong swing right now of, certainly when I talk to other ministers, of don't take the principles as a creed, don't take anything as given, and yet a real ache for, but how do we communicate who we are? So, no is the answer to the question. Okay. my daughter once embarrassed me a lot by asking a question in one of these services, and she asked, like, what a minister does all week, and I said, well, there's a short answer and a long answer, and I gave my short answer, and I said, well, that's the short answer, and she said, that was the short answer? I don't give short answers. I don't. I was not built that way. How can we encourage our society to slow down, smell the roses, and care for everyone? Oh, isn't that lovely? I'll model it, I suppose. You know, like anything else. Showing people, I mean, when I get off my hamster wheel and remember to slow down and smell the roses, it's usually because a good model in my life has shown me that. Nobody shaking their finger at me is going to do it for me. But just to remind me that I know myself, I'm happier when I slow down a little bit. So try to be the change you want to see, I guess. And by all means, remind me here to model that at church, because church should be a place that we do that for each other, but it can become going too. Ah, this is signed a Bible curious churchgoer. Do we call that bi curious for short, do you suppose? The Bible has been one of the most influential texts in Western civilization and arguably world history. I agree with that. But it seems we don't often discuss its content in our sermons. How can we as UUs engage with the Bible and build our understanding of it while keeping our distinctive identity as Unitarian Universalists? Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been a minister here for a long time, so what you see in the sermons is kind of my bias, I guess, which is I'm really interested in Bible stuff, and whenever I dig into it and do, you know, what they call exegesis in seminary, really digging into a biblical text, I'm really happy I did and find interesting stuff, but I'm also just pretty eclectic in my own theology and sources, and so I don't speak from the Bible as often as some ministers do. But it's really, really, I mean, I think what we're dealing with here is just, once you realize, oh, the Bible is just one of our sources, an important one. I mean, I think there's a reason that we have Jewish and Christian teachings listed as one of our sources, and then all the other world religions as another one. You know, this is our heritage. This is who we are culturally, even even though we encompass, you know, include a lot of people who don't come from Bible-believing cultures, that's where Unitarian Universalism grew. But you know, once you think of that, you think, well, geez, I mean, I've never preached on the Upanishads, not once, and that, you know, influences a billion people in this world, you know. And so, you know, I try to take things in around the course of the year in proportion to how they affected the globe, then in Christianity and Judaism wouldn't come up that much in their scriptures, and yet they are really important. Something I really like to do is do that more through adult religious education, which I know is, you know, not always accessible to folks in terms of their time, but if there's an interest in doing more biblical stuff, let the adult RE group know, our committee know, they'd love that. They'd love to know, and I've offered things like that before. Sometimes people are really interested and sometimes not, it ebbs and flows. Does lighting the chalice contribute to global warming? I was really feeling that this morning. I don't know when's the last time I've preached without a robe on, but it was just, no way, it's not happening today. I left it up here. Like, oh, really? Do I have to light a flame? I think it's negligible enough that it's okay. Just like driving to see a faraway sick friend, it's, you know, sometimes we just have to pay the price. But let's do a little carbon offset by maybe biking to church. Says the woman who lives in San Francisco, so she never has to do that. Okay. By the way, do you have any more back there, Tim? Do I have the whole pile here? Okay, I got them all. There's one or two back there. Make sure, send them on up, just since I'm getting close to the end of the pile here. How long have you been serving this community, and how long do you anticipate sticking around? Ooh, boy. I have been here for 16 years, come August 15th, and I'll stick around until I'm fired. I have no plans to go anywhere. And I would never have imagined that I would be here for this long. I did not have a number in mind when I came here, but this is longer than most pastorates last. Do people still use that word? And I just, I don't, I guess it's such a weird thing, right? There's ministers are hired by the whole congregation, and it takes the whole congregation to decide whether to continue to call a minister or not. So that it's when people do end up leaving, unless, you know, they're 80 and retire, there's sort of not a simple way. The congregation starts to get restive, or the minister has someplace else that they want to go, and they just sort of go, you hope, fairly peaceably. I guess that's like any other job. But anyway, the point is, what I aim to do is stick around as long as the ministry I have to offer still suits what UUCPA needs. And, you know, there's some skills I don't have that I think the congregation needs more of. That's where you all really need to step up. No minister is really good at everything. But I just love it here. I don't want to go anywhere. What can you do if a loved one interprets, I'm worried you're depressed, as a character attack? I think I'm reading that correctly. So when you say, I'm worried you're depressed, and they feel attacked, ooh, it's really hard sometimes, isn't it? I feel like maybe this is a one-on-one conversation we should have, because this is it's so individual. I mean, you can't control how other people respond, of course, but maybe I or Dan or somebody can kind of help you strategize about a particular person you're trying to reach. Because the way it's phrased, I'm worried you're depressed, doesn't seem like it should seem like an attack to anybody. It's just, I'm worried about you. I'm concerned about, you know, I don't want you to be sad. I don't want you to be suicidal. But what goes on inside us that makes us feel like depression is a weakness, or that there's something wrong with our character if we're depressed, or somebody perceives us as depressed, that's, you know, that's out there in our culture, so I can understand why people feel that way. Well, let's all try to hear those things with the love that they're intended with, if somebody does say they're worried about us. And if you wrote that question, we can talk, if that helps. The word transformation is found everywhere these days. Ugh, guilty. How do you see this vital process embodied here in the members of this congregation? In many ways, transformation is a long, fancy word for change. Although I just love the way it sounds, transform, changing form, across forms. Yeah, like any word about something big, it can be cheapened, you know, and it is a vital process. Because just change is a part of life, and as people have alluded to in other questions today, you know, the world could use some changing, and we could each use some changing. I think, you know, the congregation is a lovely mix. We're conservative in ways that people are conservative and, you know, resistant to change, and in some ways that can be really good, holding continuity. And we're itchy for change in others. I guess the main thing is, you know, are we itchy for change in ourselves instead of just in other people, which is always so tempting. You know, what I see is, at our best in this congregation, people supporting each other in the transformation that they want to bring about. Personally, like in a discussion group or writing group or forum or whatever, and in things that we want to learn, and more community-wide, nationwide, when we're trying to work for social justice. This isn't what you're asking, but a really interesting paradox of church life is that we're here both to, I mean, I feel like we're here as an institution both to assure everybody, you're wonderful the way you are, you know, and here's how we all need to change. And it's paradoxical, but I think both things are true. We're wonderful the way we are, and we're always changing and want to always be changing. So I hope that, you know, something a church can do really beautifully if when we're doing it well, and we often do it really well here, is hold that in love. You know, a social change organization, as much as I love them and I belong to a bunch of them, tend to be very much focused on the what do we need to change. And the church reminds everybody, and we love each other the way we are, and we care for each other the way we are. And even the people we have disputes with, we bring them food when they're sick. And, you know, that there's a practice of unconditional love here that I help think undergirds and supports transformation. Why don't we applaud after each song by the choir? Applaud if you think that's a great idea. I'm like it. Oh, the applause debate in Unitarian Universalist churches. I kind of prefer that we don't, but I don't know why we don't. I mean, right, we have a culture that we don't, that we applaud like at the end. And then we applaud once in a while when there's just a sort of spontaneous outburst like there was after the first song, the piece that the choir sang today, which I think is kind of nice. It's a sort of feeling like, you just raised the roof. I just can't contain myself. Whereas if it's every time, then it's sort of like what you do to be polite. I don't know. For my own part, why I don't like to applaud too much in services is because I don't want services to feel like a concert. And applause is a perfectly fine way of showing appreciation. It's culturally the way we show appreciation during concert, good performance, and a really great performance, we leap to our feet, right? But I want our services to feel different than that. And yet we want to show appreciation. I think church musicians differ on this, but some church musicians will definitely tell you, you know, an awed silence is a perfectly acceptable response to a performance by me. That when I'm playing in church, I'm not trying to get your, oh, thank you, you know, wonderful performance, you. I'm trying to help you transform your spirit. So if your spirit was transformed, great. And come up to me afterwards and tell me that. But, you know, I think we don't have a lot of language. We, the frozen people, we don't dance, we don't amen, we don't say hallelujah in the middle of services and so on. And so our way of showing I have been moved is really, you know, we only have one. I don't think it's good or bad, but I kind of like the balance we have of we clap at the end. But for heaven's sakes, you know, we don't clap after the anthem as a general rule, so if you love the way the choir sings, go tell them. Hey, everybody love the quiet way the choir sings? Our choir? Yeah. great. I mean, they sing every week, 10 months a year, and they're so fabulous, and, you know, they do a lot of work, so we should tell them. How can we talk about race and racism without using the term white supremacist? That term is ugly, hateful, and alienating. I'm confident there are no white supremacists in UUA. Ooh, that is really interesting. Well, Well, we absolutely can talk about race and racism without using the term white supremacist. People have been doing it, and there's lots of constructive work to be done. I would suggest a sort of middle way of between, you know, calling somebody, you are a white supremacist, which, you know, is probably very helpful, even if they are, and definitely not helpful if they aren't. And I just identifying white supremacy as a very strong current in our culture. And so if that sounds extreme to you, which I realize, you know, it does to this question writer, and I'm sure you're not the only person, here's what I think of when I think of white supremacist culture, white supremacy culture. I think of it very simply as the attitude that whiteness and, you know, Europeanness is normative and better. So we get that, and that takes really subtle forms. It's not just, you know, leave town, we're gonna burn down your house kind of thing. It's in what we teach in school. It's in how we don't remedy, for example, our ignorance that we read almost entirely European and North American writers, or teach that history. And that kind of thing is on a continuum with, okay, not as bad as, just on a continuum with telling people of color to go back to the countries they come from when you would never say that to white people whose ancestors also came from somewhere else, right? The attitude that there's something that we are, the norm is white. And everything else is a divergence from that, and by implication, inferior to that. Which is, you know, you look around the world, that's a really stupid attitude, but also has really poisoned our culture. So that's what I'm saying when I say white supremacy, but I am really aware that it's, for some people, it's just totally alienating, like you say. I'm blathering enough. I have only one more question. Have they really all come up? Wow. How did UUCPA's ringing the meditation bell, singing bowl tradition start? Is there any rhyme/reason requirements for UUCPA minister garb during worship? I grew up Catholic. I don't even know what the rhyme, reason, and requirements are for Catholic worship, but I didn't grow up Catholic. That's me speaking. Wow, okay, we have a twofer here. How did UUCPA's ringing the meditation bell start? My understanding is, I think somebody gave one to Ken Collier, so the last settled parish minister before me, so this would have been about 25 years ago, somewhere in his ministry, he started doing it. There's probably a more profound reason that he felt there was some need for silence or ritual that, I don't know, I've never asked Ken what he was thinking about that. I know it was a little controversial at the time. That people saw it as a piece with being too Christian, which I know sounds funny and ironic because it's not a Christian tradition, but too ritualistic or something, losing touch with our humanist roots. Anyway, I continued it because we were already doing it, and I didn't hear any objections to it, but I have mixed feelings about it. A little bit it seems appropriative. It does come from another tradition that we don't observe here of Tibetan Buddhism. On the other hand, I haven't heard any Tibetan Buddhists object to the use of it in other settings. So, I'm sure I speak for many people when I say I need a little more silence in my life and in our services. Speaking of which, I'm talking too much and we have to end our service. Okay, so is there any rhyme, reason, requirements for you, CPA, minister, garb? No, there's other than, you know, decency, modesty, there is no rhyme or reason. There's some people say that the stole is the symbol of ordination, but a UU historian named Susan Ritchie assures us that that is actually very recent. I mean, stoles have come and gone, but the sense that this is something you wear only once you are an ordained minister and not until then, that's quite recent. I personally, other than very hot days like this, like to wear a robe and a stole to separate my role here as preacher from the other things that I do, and that's why I take it off by coffee hour. My general observation is it tends to track, it correlates with theology very roughly. That if you're more humanist or atheist, you're less likely to like churchy garb. That stands to reason, I guess, but I'm a humanist atheist who likes churchy garb. Also, I mean, this stole, it's so gorgeous. I'd be so sad if I never wore it. Y'all gave it to me. Anyway, it doesn't have the sort of strict liturgical requirements that there are in the Catholic Church. Thank you for these. They will indeed give me much to ponder, and if I did not answer your questions to any kind of satisfaction, please come back with them. I want to close with an excerpt from a poem by David White called Sometimes. Sometimes you come to a place whose only task is to trouble you with tiny but frightening requests. Conceived out of nowhere, but in this place, beginning to lead everywhere. Questions that can make or unmake a life. Questions that have patiently waited for you. Questions that have no right to go away.